Hello, everyone. I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast.
Hey, guys. Before the episode starts, just want to let you know, a listener reached out to me and wished to share their message about their conservation efforts. So please give them a brief listen.
My name is Zach Bell, and I live in Okinawa, Japan, home to the endangered Ryukyu black-breasted leaf turtle. These remarkable turtles climb mountains, perch on the side of trees, and have a giant red tail that's longer than their legs. Their biology and behavior are unlike any other turtle species, but their future is uncertain. Found only on three small islands, they face many threats, such as habitat loss and wildlife trafficking. In an effort to help these turtles, my partner and I founded the Okinawa Kame Center, a nonprofit organization dedicated to conserving and protecting them. Please follow us on social media to learn more about these incredible turtles and share our posts to help spread awareness. If you'd like to connect to learn more, reach out to me directly through email or through any of our social media platforms. Thanks for listening.
And now, back to the episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate. And today I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Elaine. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Nate. And yeah, I'm glad to be here and thank you for the invite.
Yeah. So do you want to get us started off on how you first got into reptiles and amphibians and what led you up to where you are now?
Well, it's a long story, but the simple answer is that I never grew up. I'm sure most people can sympathize with that answer. I was chasing reptiles and amphibians around as a small child, and I'm still doing that now. And so one of the things that I find really satisfying about my line of work is that I get to satisfy my inner six-year-old in new and more amazing ways all the time compared to what I understood about the world when I was 6 years old. So that's basically it, just making sure that my inner child is happy and healthy whilst also trying to protect and save the species I love so much.
Okay, and you do most of your work in the UK, right?
I do, yes. Hence the British accent. But yes, most of my work is here in the UK, although I have carried out other work in places such as Malaysia, in continental Europe, in Africa, etc. But about 95% of my work has been here in the UK.
Okay. And over here in the US, UK herps don't really have that much space in the public mind, so to speak, outside of maybe the adder. So you want to go over what should people know about British herpetofauna?
Sure. I'm not surprised that people aren't all aware of them, because there aren't many to begin with. We only have 13 native species, 7 amphibians, 6 reptiles. There's not much there. However, what is there, it is enough to get most of us by, which is, it keeps us out of trouble. But obviously, as you've already mentioned, one of the species, the adder, which is our only venomous snake. And unfortunately, these guys are quite vilified by the media, and their reputation isn't really deserved. They are venomous, they are potentially dangerous, but they haven't killed anyone since 1975. And in the 100 years prior to that, when the snakes would have been far more numerous, and we didn't have access to modern medicines or antivenoms, etc., they only killed 14 people. So that level of potential danger is misplaced. If you are bitten by an adder, of course, then, do go and seek medical attention. There's still the potential to go into anaphylaxis due to a reaction to the venom. But apart from that, our other reptiles and amphibians aren't really going to cause you much harm, unless, of course, you do the old stupid maneuver of handling something and then not washing your hands and then putting your hands in your mouth and then contracting salmonellosis or another bug from either the water or the animal itself. And so our other two snake species, the grass snake and the smooth snake, are both colubrids. The grass snake is a species I am very familiar with, and I suspect we'll come back to that a little bit later on. But whoever named them kind of got it wrong, because they should be called water snakes. That's where you find them, around ponds and lakes to feed on amphibians and fish. And where do you find those guys? In fresh water. And then with smooth snakes, these guys feed on other reptiles. They're restricted to southern England to a handful of sites. They partially constrict their prey, and I've never seen one in the wild. I'm hoping to fix that this year. That's one of my New Year resolutions, is go and see a smooth snake to try and, tick that box off, given our limited diversity. Then we move into the lizards. We have three of those guys as well. You know, it's handy that these things come in threes, as the saying goes. So we have the common lizard, or the Paris lizard, which lives everywhere, essentially gives birth to live young, which is an adaptation to cooler environments. Pretty handy to have those when you're living in a country which is known for the cold and wet weather, to be able to bask, incubate those young internally, and then give birth to them. We then have the sand lizard, which is restricted to dunes and heathland. The females lay their eggs in the sand, hence that need for that bit of habitat. And then we have slow worms, which are a legless lizard, sometimes confused with snakes. Makes sense. And these guys live underground, fossorial, feed on ants and other insects. Extremely tricky to study because obviously they're underground. Moving on to the amphibians, we have three newts. So we have the great crested newt, which is the one everybody is kind of scared of in terms of disturbing them. So these are a legally protected species, just like with sand lizards and with smooth snakes. However, they often come into conflict with development because there's legal protection and mitigation needed when you disturb them. And you need a license to handle these guys. And you know, if you're working in your garden, working in an allotment or other area, and you disturb them unwittingly, some people worry that they may you know, get prosecuted for it. But as long as there's no ill intent, you're moving the animal out of harm's way, then you're perfectly fine. If you go around stumping on them, then of course there's going to be a different level of prosecution going on there. Then there are the two smaller newt species, the smooth newt and the palmate newt, both belong to the same genus, slightly different genus to great crested newts, but they're similar in size. The females look identical, so telling them apart is tricky unless they're in the hand, and even then it's hard to tell them apart. The males have a smooth undulating crest in the smooth newt, hence their name, but sometimes because of that crest they're confused with great crested newts. And the palmate newt in the springtime, the hind feet have a jet black webbing between them, and they have a small filament on the end of their tail. So that's the newts. Then we move on to the frogs and toads. There's four species there, two frogs, two toads. Common frog and common toad, exactly what they say on the tin. Both species are quite widespread throughout Great Britain and some of the other islands around the British Isles. The common toad, however, has declined quite drastically over the past 30 or so years. So they've declined by up to 70%, which is, you know, a lot due to roads, developments, fragmentation of habitats, etc. And personally, I feel that if a mammal had declined that much, or a bird, then, you know, the country would be up in arms. But because it's a toad and it's common, no one seemed to care. There's not as much evidence for common frogs declining, but again, the loss of ponds, the loss of potential breeding habitats, and fragmentation is certainly having an effect on those guys. Then we move into the rarer species. Both of these, again, are protected by law. So we have the naphtivac toad, which is another species that is adapted to those coastal dune systems. Their tadpoles love really shallow pools of water that dry out quickly, helps to reduce the amount of competition with other amphibians, but also insect predators. And historically, conservationists weren't the most clever. I would say back in the 60s and 70s, we saw these ponds, these pools where these naphtivac toads were breeding. We noticed that they were drying out quite rapidly in the summer in the heat of the sun. And so we made them larger to hold more water and hopefully give the tadpoles a fighting chance to metamorphose before they all died, unfortunately. However, by doing that, we then allowed common toads to move in and then pushed the naphtivac toads out. And with a longer term data set, they go through these boom and bust cycles. So as long as they have a couple of years within a decade where they produce offspring, the population remains stable. But obviously, as a knee-jerk reaction, we didn't know that and accidentally made the situation worse. Then there's the final species, our rarest amphibian, the pool frog. These guys, extremely interesting. There's only two populations of them. Up until the early 2000s, they were thought to be an alien introduced species. So what the Victorians loved to do during the Victorian time was go over to the continent, particularly France, places like that, grab some frogs they find in the wetlands, take them back to their country estates and put them in their ponds to one up the Joneses, essentially, and make it look like, you know, it's cool animal there. So there are introduced populations of pool frogs around, but the ones living in Norfolk, after the last male went extinct in 97, we realized that, hang on a minute, these guys are actually a native species. And so from 2005, a wild to wild reintroduction project from Sweden to Norfolk was initiated. And then since then, the tadpoles of those individuals have been head started, and both those populations are doing quite strongly at the moment, and there's potentially plans to hopefully expand out to their form of range in the UK. What makes them quite interesting is they're found in a type of pond called a pingo, and these are formed when the ice sheet that was across the UK during the last glacial maximum started to break up. Those huge chunks of ice obviously weighed quite a bit. They're sitting on quite soft ground. They create a depression. The ice melts. It fills up the depression. Boom, you've got a pond. The frogs move in and find it absolutely wonderful. It's like a 5-star hotel to them. So, they love it. Lots of that environment still exists in their former range. It's just a matter of ensuring that the frogs can find them and they're protected from disturbance and everything else that comes along with trying to reintroduce a rare and endangered species. On the continent, all of our species are doing relatively okay. It's just that being an island, it makes the whole idea of conservation a lot harder to try to achieve and also keep a cap on things when things do get wrong.
Yeah. So what has been the focus of your research?
Very good question. There have been many focuses of my research. I'm one of those people that can't stay still. If I find a gap in our knowledge, I try to fill it. So one of the species that I've been working with quite closely is the midwife toad. This is an introduced species of amphibian from continental Europe. They're pretty much all over Northwest Europe and the Iberian Peninsula. And there's a number of populations dotted around the UK or Great Britain where they currently exist and have been here for about 120 years, maybe a little bit more. The dates are a little bit contentious, but about 120 years is probably a good estimate. And these guys are quite small, quite secretive. They don't seem to compete with our native species, which is great. And they breed at a different time of year. So all of our native amphibians are explosive breeders. They breed from about Valentine's Day up until early April. With midwife toads, they come out of their little hibernation period in April and start breeding in May through to September. And so by the time their tadpoles get into the pond, or their deposits in the pond, I should say, then our native amphibians are largely leaving that space as metamorphs. So midwife toads are quite curious. They get their name from the fact that the males carry the eggs on the hind legs and then go into a crack or a crevice where the temperature is quite stable. There's a relatively stable humidity as well. And he'll sit there for 2 to 6 weeks, wait for those eggs to develop. And then when he's ready, he'll find a body of water, drop them off in the pond, and then go off and start beeping again and make a really high-pitched beeping sound to attract a mate and then grab another clutch of eggs to do that for. And because they're just right up until September time, if a clutch of eggs is placed into a pond late in the autumn, then the tadpoles will overwinter until the following spring. There'll be a much larger tadpole, and so therefore a much larger metamorph when they emerge. And in that way helps them to reduce the risk of desiccation and all that sort of stuff as well. So, you know, a little bit of adaptation to the environment as well. And all of these populations are found in people's back gardens. And so we have to network with the local communities and like, hey guys, can we come and, you know, spend some time in your yard this evening to look at these midwife toads? And most people are quite happy for us to turn up with our torches, our swabs and other gear to be able to conduct these surveys. As they're an introduced species, we need certain licensing to be able to work with them. So thank you to the guys at Natural England, our unitary authority for this, that allowed us to do this. Otherwise, there's some hefty fines and potential prison terms that come with breaking that law. So yeah, you have to be careful with these things. And obviously doing things ethically is one of the things that I pride myself with. But with these communities that we're working with the midwife toads, they often bring out tea, coffee, biscuits, cake, whatever, throughout the night up until like 2 or 3 in the morning, depending how late we're in these gardens finding these toads. And the residents just love it. The kids get involved, they get involved, and you know, there's a real community spirit there. One of the things we've been doing with the midwife toads, as well as trying to map where they are, is determine where they came from. Are all of the populations in Great Britain from a single source? Are they from multiple sources? How many introductions have there been? That sort of stuff. So that project is just wrapping up at the moment. I've just recently received the results of that. So hopefully we'll be able to finish writing that paper up soon and get it published. So fingers crossed that'll be out in the next 6 to 12 months. So keep an eye out. But also swabbing them for chytrid fungus in order to determine whether or not they're a threat to our native species. And so I've already said that we've found no evidence that they are competing with them. And midwife toads in Europe are probably the most susceptible species to chytrid fungus. They get a little sniff of it and they die. So we're using them as a barometer of health within these amphibian communities, where there may be five or six amphibian species living in these gardens, in order to determine whether or not the midwife toads and the native amphibians are, you know, getting along well. And given that all of them live sympatrically on the continent, you'd hope that they were, but sometimes things don't always go that way. But so far, things seem to be okay.
Yeah, it's almost an example of the non-native becoming a keystone species.
Maybe. And the interesting thing as well, and one of the reasons why we're interested in finding out what's going on with the midwife toads, is that in their native range back in continental Europe, they are doing quite poorly at the moment due to habitat loss, disease, all that sort of stuff. So we can find out where these British populations came from. Perhaps we can use them to reintroduce back into the native range and try to, you know, do some conservation with them rather than just wandering at them and the beeping sounds that emanate from them during the breeding season. But yeah, there's all sorts of potential there, and trying to ensure that the information that we gather has some real world positive implications as well.
Okay. So speaking of chytrid fungus, have you done any research for chytrid fungus with any other species of amphibian?
So we've swabbed a number of amphibian species for chytrid within the UK, and I continue to do so. Some of those samples are still waiting to be analysed. So we have a number, the interesting thing is we have more introduced species of amphibians than we do native ones, and so that gives us plenty to work with. So there's a newt that I'm working with currently called the Alpine newt, again, introduced from Europe. They're quite colourful. The males have a lot of blue in them, which made them quite attractive as pets. As I'm sure as you're aware, you keep something as a pet in a tank, you don't secure the lid tight enough and they will escape. And that seems to have happened a number of times across the country, as well as intentional introductions. And so near where I live, there's a large number of these newts. And so we're in the process of trying to swab some of these, but also determine how numerous they are in the environment as well. So looking forward to getting the results back from those. And likewise, there's a lot of salt marsh near where I live, and these have another introduced amphibian in them called the marsh frog, Europe's largest species of frog. And so again, we're in the process of working with those to find out whether or not they have any chytrid. And at the moment, the potential implications for chytridiomycosis in British amphibians isn't really understood. There don't appear to be any associated mass die-offs, any of that sort of stuff in our amphibians, but given the other threats of habitat loss, inbreeding, climate change, you know, the usual big guns, add disease in that mixture, perhaps it will lead to potential declines in the future. So keeping an eye on where it is, what species it's affecting, we can try to plan for the future and ensure that if it does become an issue, we can act appropriately, which again is part of the thinking behind all of this stuff, is just trying to get a jump on things if and when we need to act.
Okay, so chytrid fungus is in the UK, but it hasn't really had a massive impact yet. Is that what?
Not yet, no. So some species are more, what's we're looking for here, are more susceptible than others, but there haven't been, you know, mass die-offs of amphibians. There's been, you know, a handful here or there. But it's not like in the neotropics or elsewhere where, you know, you've just got ponds that have been eradicated due to chytridiomycosis.
Okay. You mentioned you did some research with grass snakes. You want to go back to that?
Sure. No, while we're talking about mycosis, let's go for it. So I studied grass snakes for my PhD, and one of the things I was studying within the population I was looking at was the impacts of ophidiomycosis, formerly known as snake fungal disease. And so this is another emerging infectious disease that was detected here in Great Britain back in 2016 for the first time in wild snakes. But looking at historical archive specimens, it dates back to about 2010, but that's when the start of that collection begins. It's probably been here for a little bit longer than that without anybody realizing. And so my PhD was looking at trying to characterize this disease in a wild population of snakes. and also trying to figure out whether or not it's having a negative impact on them or not. And so I spent 3 summers running around a private nature reserve, catching as many snakes as possible during the height of the COVID pandemic as well, trying to get as much data as possible to be able to draw these conclusions, as well as some other questions that I was also asking in terms of the behavior of the snakes, different methods for surveying, diet, etc. And so what is most interesting, and I think this is just an artifact of a better understanding of emerging diseases within wildlife in general, is that there appears to be more and more diseases emerging within wildlife. And whether or not it's emerging in terms of them or us is a whole different kettle of fish, because some of these diseases may have been there for decades, centuries, and whatnot, and we just have, you know, looked straight past them, or they've only just become a threat in recent times because of climate change, inbreeding, or another stressor, which has then impacted the immune system of those species and then starting to cause these problems, which is one of the reasons why I'm trying to find out which species are affected by chytrid in the UK and where it is, you know, so important for planning for the future. But with grass snakes, I should have said earlier, they're our largest species of snake. They grow to about 1.8 meters in length, although the largest I caught over that three summers was 1.2 meters. And they kind of do what most species of snakes like them do, which is they like to play dead and they musk all over you. So thankfully, I am now impervious to grass snake musk because I caught so many of them that, you know, I've got used to it now. And, you know, it's almost comically hilarious, the situations I found myself in, because between my field site and the house I was staying at the time was the local pub. And so after running around my field site for 12 hours a day, I'd run in there, have a quick pint, and then go home, get showered, get some food, and get ready for the next day. And in the height of the summer, when you've been sweating all day, you're covered in grass snake musk, you walk in there, and everyone just turns around and looks at you. And then the landlord's like, "Steve, mate, you been chasing them snakeskin, didn't you?" I'm like, "Yeah, how could you tell that? We can smell it from here. Like, go home and get changed first, mate, and then come back." So, you know, being impervious kind of has its downsides, because you can't tell when you're just, you know, reeking of grass snakes, but everybody else around you can. So yeah, there's some funny stories like that around. But again, you know, I managed to catch a large number of snakes, get the data I needed for the project, and make that successful, despite all of the challenges that that we as a society faced during the COVID years. I will say now that I caught hundreds of snakes each summer, and I'm pretty sure that I must have been a hawk or something in a previous life to have the reaction speeds to catch snakes. The most challenging thing I found, people always ask me this, is what was the most challenging part? Is the fact that I would lift up some of my cover objects. I was using artificial cover objects to be able to increase the detection probability of the snakes. Is that when there's one or two snakes underneath there, you've kind of got your targets aimed for. You know which ones you're going to try to grab and then process. When there's, you know, a dozen or so, and they're all slithering off in different directions, you don't know, you know, where to aim or what to go for. So you just have to, like, jump in there and hope for the best. The other thing I should say as well is that, thankfully, the site that I did all my research on, it likes to flood in the winter, so there aren't any other reptiles there. There's no adders or anything to be worried about. So, you know, if I saw a snake, I could be, you know, 99.999% sure it was a grass snake, and, you know, could just jump on it and there'd be no ill effects unless, you know, I squished it or, you know, I landed right, etc. But, you know, it's not like there's a potential misidentification for a grass snake and a venomous snake, and even if there was, the two look very different. Grass snakes are like a dark green, it's an olive color with barred markings down their sides and a black and yellow collar around the neck, and then adders are usually, well, depending on the sex, they're either like a coppery brown color or a silver with a zigzag pattern on the back, so, you know, quite distinguishable between the two of them. And so you're running around the snake reserve, catching as many snakes as possible, measuring them, weighing them, swabbing them, getting all of that sort of data. And the one thing you realize is that when you have a large sample size like this, is that wild populations of snakes have their own individual personalities. Some of the snakes, you know, as soon as I've picked them up, they're playing dead, made my life a lot easier by trying to photograph them, swab them, and measure them, etc. because they're all limp. You know, when you're trying to study snakes, when they're being cooperative like that, makes things 10 times easier. Then there are some snakes that just refuse to cooperate, and even after being put in a pillowcase to calm them down for a little while, will come out and be hissing, be like trying to hood up like mini cobras and stuff. Like, guys, like, chill. We've done this before, you know. You know the process. I'll be 30 seconds tops, and you can go back underneath your cover object or chase toads, whatever you're going to do. But, you know, the longer you're messing around, the longer it's going to take us both. And I must say, I'm one of those weirdos that does talk to snakes, despite the fact they can't hear me. And the field site that I do all this work on is used quite a bit by production companies to film wildlife. It isn't just the snakes that are there, it's birds, it's mammals, you know, it's a nature reserve that is a Eden in a, you know, a bleak landscape of agriculture, so everything is there. And there was a French film crew that were there filming cuckoos parasitizing reed warbler nests. And they came every day in their hire car, parked it in a certain location, so I knew not to survey that part of the reserve until after they'd gone, so I didn't disturb their filming. One day, they parked their car in a completely different location. They must have been running late or something, so they didn't see it until the last minute. But at that point, I'd already lifted up one of my cover objects, caught the snake, started talking to it, and about two meters away in the reeds was this French cameraman in his wetsuit filming these birds, just laughing his head off while, you know, this crazy Brit is talking to the snake. So somewhere in whatever production company that was, their archive, is that take of him trying to film these birds and just like laughing his head off because of, you know, me talking to the snake a few meters away. So there are a lot of stories like that with field workers, I'm sure many people are familiar with. And you've just got to, you know, just got to laugh at yourself and, you know, realize that for the outside world, we do seem like a bunch of absolute lunatics. But I think that comes with the passion and also the intrigue that research comes. I wouldn't have changed it for the world.
Yeah. Okay. So your research with grass snakes was focusing mostly on ophidiomyces, formerly known as snake fungal disease, right?
Yes.
So what impact has ophidiomyces had on British snake populations, both grass snakes? You obviously haven't done much work with smooth snakes yet, but also adders.
This is a tough question to give a definitive answer to, because we don't really know at the moment. We don't have enough data to be able to determine what's going on. When it comes to grass snakes, there's only a handful of populations in the country that have been monitored for some period of time. The population I was working with was one of them, and there's a couple of others nearby. But apart from that, there's no real long-term monitoring of them, which is a shame. And I think it's because they're, you know, this, what is seen as this common and widespread species, why would you want to work with them when there's, you know, these more rarer and sexier species where, you know, there's a lot more, potentially a lot more to be discovered or found or impact to be had. So hopefully in the coming years, we'll see more people monitoring grass snake populations, and that's something that I'm, you know, quite big on at the moment, is trying to get local organizations, whether it be a volunteer organization or a charity that manages a nature reserve, is trying to get them out and about monitoring their grass snakes long term using similar methods to mine, but being a little bit more hands off and just trying to count how many individuals are present, what days, and just build that data set up so we can see how these populations are fluctuating through space and time, if they are at all, and what trend that they are following. With adders, we don't really know how ophidiomycosis is affecting them either, mainly because nobody has really surveyed them for the fungus, although we know from opportunistic sampling that a handful of them have been found with skin lesions that are consistent with ophidiomycosis, but they don't always test PCR positive. And one of the intriguing things about ophidiomycosis is that there are a dozen different diseases that all present exactly the same way. It's like in humans having flu-like symptoms. You know, you can't really drill it down unless you do some testing. And when we're only testing for one disease, we can only rule that one disease out. And there's probably a whole host of other bacteria, fungi out there that we're not aware of that are causing similar skin lesions in some of these snakes. that may look like snake fungal disease or phytomycosis, but they aren't. And so there needs to be more research there. The worrying thing with adders are at the moment is that they are in a pretty bad way in the UK. A number of their populations are declining quite rapidly. They're isolated. They're suffering from inbreeding depression. They are being persecuted despite the fact it's illegal. There's a whole host of factors that are pushing them further and further away from a favorable conservation status and closer towards regional extinction. And on that list, I suspect that disease is probably, you know, at the bottom, because there's far greater risks to them at the moment. Although I am more than happy to be proven wrong. Although at the moment, we just don't have the data to suggest what's going on. With the grass snakes, the population I was studying is only a single population, so we don't know whether or not what I found was representative, but I found skin lesions that were consistent with ophidiomycosis and that tested PCR positive in about a third of snakes that I captured of all age classes and sizes, etc. Although they were more prevalent in the larger snakes, which kind of makes sense because they're going to be adults, they're going to be ranging more, trying to find mates, nesting areas, etc., and are also sloughing a lot less frequently. If you're a small snake, you can potentially outpace the growth of the fungus by sloughing, you know, more frequently. When you're a larger snake, that's tougher to do. And so that may be one of the ways that these smaller snakes are being able to outpace the disease and the onset of those clinical symptoms. But again, we need more research to find out what's going on. So in 5-10 years time, let's have another chat and see where things are going from there, and where my predictions have led, and whether or not we've got any more answers, because at the minute it's just all going to be wild speculation.
All right. So you mentioned you actually have more non-native species amphibians than native species in the UK. So what are some of the more prominent non-native herps, and how impactful are they in the UK?
Again, a lot of it comes down to us not really knowing, but one of the more obvious species, I guess you can say, conspicuous, that's what I'm looking for, are red-eared sliders and other terrapins. So like many places around the world, throughout the launches of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle franchise films and TV series, etc., people went out and bought sliders and then, you know, bought them for 50p, kept them in a tank in the house, and then they grew quite rapidly. They kind of outstayed their welcome and then got dumped in local ponds, rivers, lakes, etc. And then in 1997, the importation of breaded sliders was outlawed, but people still bred them, and there were some other related species that have been traded since. And so I think at this current moment in time, there are 22 species of freshwater turtle that have been recorded in the UK. And that's everything from sliders to musk turtles, alligator snapping turtles, Chinese soft shells. You know, that there's a whole host of species out there that have unfortunately found their way into our waterways. So we have no native terrapins or freshwater turtles, which means that when people find these basking along their local riverbanks or ponds when they go to feed the ducks, etc., you know, they tend to, you know, be the talk of the town or that area. And we don't really know what their impact is on our native species at the moment. So far, thankfully, they don't really seem to be breeding, but as climate change advances, that may change as well. And so, again, these are another group of species that we need to be able to monitor, keep an eye on for when the situation does change and those circumstances that they need become more favorable, in case we need to you know, manage them. At the time being, that some authorities are removing these animals and culling them. Not everybody is, because it's more hassle to try to catch them than it is to just leave them in place. So depending on how big the water body is and how many of them are present, it makes it either easier to just leave them alone or easier to cull them. And so you have to take that into consideration. And the other issue as well is that, like most economies, these local authorities are feeling the pinch in terms of all the different services they have to provide. If they have to spend a few thousand pounds to hire someone to go out and catch these freshwater turtles, that's money that could be invested in schools and libraries and in other other areas that people would probably more likely want that money to be spent in. So again, that's part of the climate as well, which makes it a bit tricky. There are some other amphibians as well. There's a couple of lizards that we have, particularly down on the south coast. So we have wall lizards, again, another European species found on walls, if you couldn't guess. The name is quite descriptive. And these guys have already adapted to our climate, which is crazy. So the females lay their eggs later than they do on the continent, so that the embryos are more developed, and then they leave them in the crevices and the walls that they live in. The embryos develop, the little lizards hatch out, and then boom, they go about their lizardy ways. However, they are at the moment outcompeting common lizards and sand lizards in some of these sites, and directly predating upon them as well. And then in some of those areas on the south coast as well, we have western green lizards and other species from Europe. Very large, the males are bright green. These guys seem to be a little bit rarer than wall lizards are currently, but they're still having a negative impact. So yeah, again, you have to keep an eye on them in order to be able to ensure that if and when you have to manage them, you know where they are and all of that sort of stuff. So yeah, lots of stuff to do and keep people happy and busy, etc. And lots of unknowns to try to identify and fill in, which keeps people like me busy as well. And my students as well, which is great, because they get to do some research that answers some of my personal questions, but also gives them you know, that step up and be able to answer some, you know, some really important questions.
It's interesting you bring up wall lizards, because that's the one thing you and I have in common, I guess, is European wall lizards are also invasive of all places in Ohio in the middle west of the United States.
How did they get there?
Some guy in the 50s went on vacation in northern Italy and brought some back in a briefcase. And decided to release them in his backyard in Cincinnati. So now they've spread around the whole Cincinnati, southwest Ohio, southeast Indiana, north central Kentucky area.
Okay, damn, that's crazy. So something similar happened here. So most of those European species that I've mentioned used to be popular pets. So prior to the 80s, the exotic reptile amphibian pet trade in Great Britain was European species. It was easy to just jump on a ferry, go over to France, load up your car and come back again. But during the 80s and the early 90s, when we started to crack the husbandry for chameleons and corn snakes and all that sort of stuff, and they became far more numerous this side of the pond, all of those European species essentially became worthless. And so anyone that was dealing with them just like dumped them in the local park or nature reserve, etc., and just cut their losses. And of course, some of those species didn't survive. The winter got them, or the habitat just wasn't favorable. But by chance, some of those habitats were favorable, and those populations have kind of persisted since. Although the Victorians also did a good job of introducing some of the species as well, because they had, I don't know if you're aware of this, but they had acclimatization societies. And so one of the things they were trying to do was gather wildlife from across the British Empire and ensure that we had it in London to be able to, you know, show the exploits of the handiwork of the empire. And that's why we've probably got so many weird and wacky introduced species in London, including things like parrots, pelicans, grey squirrels, you know, there's all sorts of crazy stuff going on in the British countryside, but that's a conversation for another day.
Sounds like a more temperate version of South Florida.
It is, in a certain extent, yeah.
All right. So you very beginning of the pod, excuse me. So what can people do to help preserve British herpetofauna?
That is a wonderful question, and something that I often raise with people. I think if you are, you know, this goes multiple ways to helping other species as well. So if you want to help out British herpetofauna, one of the things that I encourage people to do is to just dig a pond in their garden in order to allow amphibians to breed. Obviously, at the same time that they give space for different aquatic insects and other species like that at home as well. And this is one of the interesting things is, at the moment, a lot of our amphibian populations are restricted to urban areas, mainly because in the rural areas where you'd expect them to be, there's no ponds left. We fill them all in after the Second World War, in order to maximize the area we had for farming, for agriculture, to try and feed the starving nation. And that lack of suitable habitat in rural areas means that all of the amphibians nowadays mostly are found in rural areas where you wouldn't expect to find them, which is, you know, interesting. But there's a trend recently where people moving to a house where there was a pond, they fill it in because they don't want their dog drowning in it, or they've got a young child, etc., instead of just putting a fence around it or making it safe, which, you know, to me, it costs more time and money to empty the pond and fill it in than it does to, you know, put a perimeter around it. But hey ho, that's just me. So if you want to try to help the native amphibians, dig a pond in your back garden. And I will say now that if you're tempted to move frog spawn from one site to another, don't. It's highly questionable in terms of spreading invasive species, pathogens, etc. And all of our native amphibians are protected by law from sale as well. So please don't buy anything that you see online. So, oh yeah, it's great to chuck it in your pond because it's likely a non-native species and you'll be doing more harm than good to begin with. Let the amphibians come to you. And sometimes it takes a couple of years for the ponds to mature enough for those amphibians to find them. They're not going to be there straight away. Although sometimes they are. It depends how close the nearest population is and how quickly your pond becomes favorable to them. The other thing as well is try to ensure that some of your garden is a little bit rough and ready. You know, don't mow your lawn straight down to the soil. Keep an area that is long where wildflowers can grow and those amphibians can hunt. Maybe some reptiles will be there as well. If you have space, try to create a log pile so that you give them somewhere to overwinter. And then additionally as well, just make a compost heap in the corner somewhere. This is great for reptiles. Grass snakes will lay their eggs there. Maybe the amphibians will hibernate in there as well. And one of the things that I think is valuable here as well is that by trying to make your garden more naturalistic, by providing these habitats, you can also use it as an educational tool with your children, if you have them, in order to demonstrate why you're doing what you are, in order to benefit the local amphibians, the insects, the small mammals, etc., and, you know, do your own little bit of conservation in your back garden where you have the control to do it. And as I said, sometimes it takes a little bit of a while for those species to appear. Sometimes you won't always see them, but they'll leave signs behind that have been there. And as a nation, typically, you know, we're known as a nation of nature lovers, but most people are what I would call armchair conservationists, where, you know, they love nature in the broadest sense, but they don't want to get up and do anything about it. Whereas by just being a little bit messy in a garden, you can have a huge positive impact on the wildlife that hopefully can utilize that.
So, like back at the beginning of the podcast, you mentioned you did some work outside of the UK. One of the nations you did was Malaysia. Do you want to give a brief overview of that work?
Sure. Why not? So, back in 2016, so long ago now, Jesus, I was part of a project involved with surveying amphibian communities on Mount Kinabalu in Sabah in Malaysia. And essentially, what we were doing for 3 months out there is going out each day and evening to survey a number of different transects and detect as many amphibians as we could, identify them to species level, sex, measure them, weigh them, collect all the usual biometric stuff, and we also left some acoustic monitoring devices in the area as well to be able to catch any of the frogs that we missed, because unfortunately we couldn't be there 24/7 in all of the different places as much as we tried. And so we were trying to figure out what the different altitudinal niches of some of these species were, whether or not they were being impacted by climate change, and if the acoustic monitoring device that we had designed based around the single board computer, a Raspberry Pi, actually worked. And so this was long before the days of audio moths, which some people may be familiar with, for a little little device you can buy online. I think they're close to £100 each. I don't know what is that in US, probably 120, 125. And you can stick a single AA battery in there, program it using your PC or Mac, leaving it out in the environment, and it will record the time of day you've set it at, the frequency you've set it at, and all that sort of stuff. So that essentially is a much easier way of doing things compared to the way that we did things with our Raspberry Pis and everything else. But at the time, audio morphs didn't exist, or if they did, they were extremely expensive. So we had to find another solution to doing this, which we did, which was highly successful. And despite the fact it's been 8.5 years since we did this work, I'm hoping that this year, finally, that research gets published, because again, it's a very important project. It's one that I hold dear to my heart, because who doesn't love running around a mountain for 18 hours a day trying to find amphibians? There were all sorts of other cool wildlife we saw whilst in the rainforest as well. Obviously, a whole host of reptiles, insects, some gastropods that were quite cool, birds as well, if you're a birder. So, you know, it kept us entertained, but at the same time, it was a lot of hard work, and lots of these projects I've been involved with are hard work, both mentally and physically. And so if you are going to undertake a project like what I've been involved with, then I encourage you to try to just be conscious of that, so that you don't give up halfway through, right before things start to pay off. You know, stick with it. It will get tough. Science never goes to plan. I wasn't, you know, exactly expecting the pandemic right in the middle of my PhD, but unfortunately it happened. And I'm sure, you know, none of us saw that coming. But, you know, lots of great science has come out in the past few years despite that. And there's no reason why nobody else shouldn't be able to do that too. So, yeah, the Malaysia stuff had a few issues. There were some problems there. We overcame them. And hopefully that research should be published soon. So keep an eye out for that as well.
All right. Do you keep any herps, like snakes or amphibians, in a captive setting?
I don't keep any snakes, no, but I have a couple of amphibians. So the alpine newts I mentioned, if you catch them, you can't release them back into the wild legally. And I've captured a few whilst bottle trapping for great crested newts in the past. So it's basically where you take a soda bottle, you cut the lid off, insert it upside down in the bottle, and then stake that into a pond. The newt swims in, it can't get out, you come back in the morning, boom, you can count your newts. But therefore, by capturing the alpine newt, you either have to euthanize it or take it home. And to me, it's a source of free newts. So I've got some in the tank on my desk in order, you know, I don't understand how they're classed as an invasive species, because they are quite stupid. But I guess, you know, that's most amphibians, unfortunately, is they're not the brightest spark. But in the right circumstances, you know, they can be quite prolific. And I also have some African dwarf frogs, Hymenochirus, that were gifted to me by a friend who came to the UK, studied, moved back to Asia, and couldn't take his frogs with him. So, yeah, Nathan, your frogs are still doing well, mate, and they're here next to me at the moment.
All right. And final question, some might even say the toughest question, what is your favorite herp?
You had to do this, didn't you? So you have to break this down. So the my favorite herb that I'd love to see in the wild would either be a Komodo dragon, just because, you know, world's largest lizard, venomous, who would not want to, you know, try and see those, or a king cobra. And the reason why I'd love to see a king cobra is because I'm almost 2 meters tall, I'm 6'4". King cobras grow to be tall enough for a female to be able to look me in the eye when they hood up. That has, you know, got to be one of the most primeval feelings of being made to feel small by a snake. Not that I'd want to piss off a king cobra that it did that, but, you know, just being able to see an animal that size would be, you know, in a wild would be spectacular. So those are two experiences I'd like, not necessarily favorite species, but I think in terms of my favorite species, it's going to have to be the grass snake. And the reason being is that most people say that when you complete a PhD on an animal, you never want to see it again. I miss those guys. Like, you know, whenever I see a grass snake, I always think of those fond days running around Norfolk trying to find them, even in harsh weather, whether it be wind, rain, you know, really warm. You know, I was out and about collecting data, and, you know, personally, it was some of the best days of my life. Despite the pandemic and the other challenges and stuff we had, just being out in nature, having fun. So the memories that I have associated with that species mean that it is my favorite. And yeah, they're just the goofiest little noodles that are going because they play dead, they must call over you and make your life a lot easier as a researcher to be able to then collect your data, pop it back. And I love the fact that I don't know what it's like with North American species, but whilst they are playing dead, they'll keep a little eye on you, so they can see what's going on. And sometimes you put them back in the grass and they're still watching you for a good few minutes afterwards. And you're really like, hang on a minute, has this snake actually died, or are they just, putting on an Oscar winning performance? And then only then do they come round and sliver off. But, you want to make sure that you haven't accidentally killed it or, done any more harm than good. But no, every time the snake will just put in that little bit extra, 110% trying to sell the idea that it had actually died instantaneously upon me picking it up.
All right. That finishes off the list of questions I had. Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
Not that I can think of, no. It's been wonderful to be on the podcast, to share some of my experiences and hopefully connect with some some like-minded people. So looking forward to seeing who listens to this and gets in touch afterwards, because it's always great to interact with the community and just provide a different angle and viewpoint on some of the things that people may or may not be aware of. So again, thanks for the invite.
All right, and how can people get in contact with you?
The best way is probably through Instagram, Twitter, or Blue Sky. And my handle for all of those is the same, which is Stevo Alain, Stevo Allain. And you should be able to, just find me and shoot me a message, and we can chat frogs, snakes, lizards, whatever. We're wherever it takes us. More than happy to chat to people and share the love for herpetofauna.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.